I call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members and staff, this is our second remote hearing of the special session, and we are live streaming. Before we get started, I'd like to go through a few of the perfunctory items before our regular business. We're holding this hearing pursuant to House Rule 10.10, passed on March 26th in the regular session, which allows for remote hearings to take place during the peacetime emergency. The rule sunsets on January 31st. To mute, please keep yourself on mute when you're not voting or speaking. If you're on mute and you have this window selected, you can hold down your space bar to be heard and then let it go to be unmuted, but you have to be in this window to do that. If you're playing computer solitaire in another window and you press your space bar, you will not be heard. You have to be on Zoom. Committee staff can mute and unmute you and will assist when we move to voting. For those who call into Zoom, you hit *6 to unmute. And if you want to speak, raise your hand. Use the raise your hand function. Do not take it down. Committee staff will take it down. If you're on the phone, you can hit *9 to raise your hand or email Rachel Ganani, the committee CA, or Jenna Mouse, the committee legislative assistant. Thank you for being patient. We'll be taking breaks periodically. And also note that because this is a special session, we've got members and presenters who are in other committees at the same time. So bear with us because we may have to shuffle. That is not uncommon in special sessions or toward the end of a regular session. And it's made even more so now because of the multiple hearings going on related to these bills that we're taking at today. After consultation with my GOP colleagues, the procedural motions will be done viva voce, and we will do roll calls for bills that go to the general register or another committee, but for amendments or minutes, we'll be doing viva voce. I've been notified a quorum is present. The committee legislative assistant will call the roll to verify attendance.
Chair Lesh.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Cantrell.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Present.
Representative Considine.
Present.
Representative Hassan.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Go ahead, Ms. Mouse. Give me a heads up when you've completed the roll call.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Here.
Members, today we will be taking up four bills. The first will be, and these we may shuffle these because I think as I've recently shuffled, but the four bills we'll be taking up, not necessarily in this order, will be House File 80, Representative Gomez, authorizing limited use of eminent domain. There's an A1 author's amendment. This will be going to Ways and Means. House File 83, Representative Hassan, on housing, providing residential assistance providing assistance to residential and commercial tenants in areas impacted by civil unrest. This will go to Ways and Means as well. House File 90, Representative Knorr, establishing a special master to make awards to compensate for damages suffered by persons resulting from similar civil unrest. This is similar to what we did for the 35W disaster fund. There is an author's amendment, and the motion will be to Ways and Means. And then House File 97, Representative Kunesh-Kudin, private data disclosure to include tribal nations. The motion on this bill will be recommended to be placed on the general register because no fiscal impact. But the first item we have up is the approval of minutes of June 15th. We are going to do a voice vote on the minutes. Vice Chair Moeller has reviewed the minutes and makes a motion to approve the minutes for June 15th. Is that right, Representative Moeller?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Then all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails and the minutes of June 15th are approved. Now, recognizing we may need to juggle, Representative Gomez, are you queued up or ready to go, or do you got to be in another committee? How are you for going first? Are you good?
Yep, I need to go first here because I'm presenting this exact bill in another committee that's happening right now, and I'm late in the order there. So if I can go first, that would be great.
Let's get moving then. I move that House File 80 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Gomez, please tell us about your bill. And if you can, I know you will be brief, but just be brief because we'll move forward to the A1 author amendment after that.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So today we're going to hear a number of different parts of the Promise Act, which is sort of a mouthful. I'm going to read it to you, though. It's providing resources, opportunity, and maximizing investments in striving entrepreneurs. So this is for help in reconstruction of damage due to the civil unrest that took place mostly across Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also some other surrounding communities during the civil unrest, following the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis Police Department, which happened in my district. I don't know if you'd like me to give some opening remarks or move the amendment, or it's kind of up to you.
Why don't you move the amendment and cool. Explain that, Representative Gomez.
Yeah, so the amendment, A1. I'm looking at at the version I'm presenting in the other committee. I think it's the A1 amendment.
It's the A1 amendment.
Yeah, so basically, the underlying bill, House File 80, provides for some limited use of eminent domain to cities that were impacted by the civil unrest. And actually, the amendment does constrain the geography somewhat. So it, instead of using the, basically the underlying bill uses the governor's executive order that called out the National Guard, so Executive Order 20-64, to define the geography that was eligible for this. And due to some feedback that I received, you know, I know that like eminent domain is a very powerful tool. And so we really want, when we're authorizing government to use it, we want them to use it judiciously. And so in response to some feedback that I got, I have constrained the geography to, you know, you can kind of read it sort of Minneapolis on Lake Street and West Broadway and St. Paul and University Avenue. There's also this additional locations or zones designated by the governor in case there are, you know, sort of damage outside of those zones that would need this tool. And then I have in the original bill has the section 2, which refers to a redevelopment moratorium. And this is actually a tool that cities already have via the use of interim ordinance to constrain development. And it's, you know, it's sort of designed to protect against some of the issues that we already will see developing in these corridors. But we, after talking to the city, kind of decided that it sort of just kind of says what's already there in law, and so it's unnecessary. So that's the second part of the amendment. Is that it?
Okay, thank you. Representative Moeller, you're moving this amendment, is that correct?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the amendment has been moved. And then Representative Lucero, you had your hand up. Is that right? Was that about the amendment?
I did, but that was actually before the bill was moved. I had a different comment, but I can, it's not related to this. I can do it. If you could recognize me after this bill is moved, before the next bill, that'd be great.
Okay, will do. Yes, someone remind me, thanks. I'll remember though. Okay, so the amendment's been moved. Any comments to the amendment? Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I have the bill in front of me, and I think this amendment is pretty straightforward. If Representative Gomez could just identify which lines, is it all of Section 2 that will be deleted?
Representative Gomez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yeah, that's correct. We're just getting rid of Section 2. So everything from 2-13 on.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me just make sure. So starting at line 2.13, and you're moving everything down to 3. You're moving everything down to line 3.2.
Representative Gomez.
Or I mean 3.3. Yeah. So it just kind of leaves the effective date, which starts on, or on mine starts on 3.4. So I'm not sure. But yeah, basically everything from in Section 2 up to the effective date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. I don't see any of their hands up. So we'll proceed to a vote on Representative Moeller's motion. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, say no. The motion passes. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill, Representative Gomez, were there? You've got Mr. McGrath here testifying in opposition. Do you have any testifiers in favor ahead of time?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't.
Okay, then we'll move to Mr. McGrath. Go ahead, Mr. McGrath. Please state your full name and title for the record.
Chairman Lesh, members of the committee, Representative Gomez, thank you. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the Senior Legislative Counsel for the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is the nation's leading advocate against eminent domain abuse. And when I say abuse, I don't mean the use of eminent domain for the taking of private property for a road, a park, or a school. Those are legitimate public uses in which there is no dispute. What I do mean by the word abuse is the taking of private property from one private owner for the benefit of another private owner, a private developer. This is where the government is acting as a real estate broker, using its powers to force the sale of a property. For 25 years, the Institute for Justice has litigated and lobbied across the country. Let me just quickly go through three cases that illustrate the type of abuse against which we have litigated. In 1996, a casino owner named Donald Trump wanted to take the property owned by Vera Koking. We represented Ms. Koking, and we won against his efforts to collude with the city Atlantic City to do the type of taking of private property that is inherent in this bill. Secondly, and most famously, we represented Suzette Kilo. She and her neighbors in New London, Connecticut, worked with us to take her little pink house in that case all the way to the United States Supreme Court on the question of whether New London could take her property for someone else's private development. We lost that case 5-4 at the Supreme Court in 2005. But the public reaction to the idea that a municipality could take someone else's private property, to take someone's private property for another private developer, was so strong.
Did Mr. McGrath freeze up, or was it just me?
I can still hear him. He was still going for me.
It's okay. You.
Okay.
Just you.
All right, keep going.
I will. Representative Lesh, thank you. I'm glad you interrupted when you froze. So after the Supreme Court decision, 44 states, including Minnesota, changed their law to prevent the very type of taking that is at this bill.
And then more locally in 2006, I represented Advanced Shoring, just a stone's throw away from the Capitol when the St. Paul Port Authority tried to take their property on Jackson Street. Mr. Chairman, my colleagues and I oppose this bill for two reasons. One, it is unnecessary, and two, it is unjust. It is unnecessary because Minnesota law would allow the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul, and it allows every other city to take private property when the property is blighted, when the property has environmental contamination, or when the property is abandoned. Section 117 has enormous flexibility for the type of development that should occur in Minneapolis and St. Paul and across the state. In fact, it is so flexible that it allows the taking of one perfectly fine building for every one blighted or contaminated building. Secondly, Minneapolis and St. Paul enjoy already and don't need this bill because they could go into the marketplace and buy any property that they want. And there, it seems premature to suggest, Mr. Chairman, that there are holdouts that justify this power. The second reason for my firm's opposition to this bill, members, is that it is unjust. The Supreme Court called the eminent domain powers the despotic powers, in that they are a power to force someone to sell unwillingly his property. Most overwhelmingly, Americans oppose this. In fact, in 2006, 87% of Minnesota legislators in the House supported the bill that this House File 80 is attempting to circumvent. This bill is about force. It's about forcing a property owner to involuntarily sell his property. And it is targeted at the people who want to rebuild their own property. Having failed to protect their buildings from arson and thievery, now these cities want to use this despotic power to force the sale of their property. I submit to you, Mr. Chairman and members, nothing could be more wrong. I would be pleased to answer your questions, and thank you again for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 80.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I will have a question for the bill author after we're done with for and against testimony. So my question for Mr. McGrath here is, what is the need for this bill? You cited the change in Minnesota law after the Supreme Court case. Is that change in Minnesota law that prohibits this action, is that what is the driver for the language before us so that it can create an exception to present Minnesota law?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, I think Representative Gomez might be in a better position, but what I suggest to explain the rationale for this bill, but what I suggest is that it is unneeded because under current law, Minneapolis and St. Paul can go out and buy the property. They don't need any eminent domain powers. Secondly, if the property is blighted and there's an unwilling seller, or if the property is contaminated and there's an unwilling seller, or if the property is abandoned and there is an unwilling seller, Minnesota current law or empowers without any change, without this bill, for municipalities to buy, to use eminent domain powers and to take those properties.
Mr. Chair, with that, then I guess I'll throw the question over to Representative Gomez.
Representative Gomez, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero, for the question. And thanks, Mr. McGrath, for tossing it over to me, because certainly, since you disagree with the bill, you wouldn't be able to explain the underlying rationale. So I guess I just want to, you know, actually a number of the representatives on this committee have visited my district, and I want to extend my appreciation for that and for the attention and care and compassion that members on both sides of the aisle have shown to the communities who have been, you know, who've been rocked by what has been happening in our state over the last few weeks. You know, those of you who, it's sort of hard to describe without seeing it with your own eyes, what it is to have a formerly thriving commercial corridor destroyed and in a lot of, you know, many buildings burned. And, you know, I am particularly thankful for the time that so many members took to speak to business owners in our districts. Because when you talk to those folks, you know, to people like Faisal and Ibrahim Demag, who are business owners in Representative Hassan's district, and then those of you who you met Faisal when you came, those members who came to visit, they own the Chicago Lake furniture store that was burned to the ground, and that you know, the steel beams were like unrecognizable, but kind of curled up on themselves. And you know, they've been in the neighborhood for 25, 27 years, I think. They're East African immigrants. They've put all of their time, all of their life savings into building a corner of, you know, building up a corner of the world that of our district, of our city, that had been, you know, it's right next to the Sears building, which was empty for 15 years. So, you know, the area is really struggling a lot. And, you know, I'm trained as an environmental scientist, and I sometimes think of business corridors as like being an ecosystem, where there are the physical structures, there's the human capital that comes in, there are the families who put all of their energy and love into these places. There's, you know, we heard there are nonprofits that support the businesses that are there. There's transit and public infrastructure. There's, you know, right on the corner of Lake and Chicago, there was a Career Force Center, right, which is a deed property that connected people in our neighborhood to jobs. So having this kind of like physical destruction, you really are like interrupting an entire ecosystem. And so the intent of the Promise Act is to devote resources and to give municipalities tools to restore what is there. And the reason that we are, that I'm proposing this modest and temporary expansion of eminent domain is because of the danger of completely changing the character and displacing those people like Mr. Demag, who's put his life's work into this corner. They said very clearly, we want to stay, we want to rebuild here, right? And so I just would disagree with Mr. McGrath's read, because you know, what this does is it creates, so basically eminent domain has to be used for a public purpose or a public use, even, you know, if you're using the blight definition to take the property. So this is usually for public infrastructure that a city or a municipality or a unit of government owns. So like, I mean, I think it was Mr. McGrath who's talking about roads, parks, sewers. That's sort of the normal application of eminent domain. And what we're saying with this bill is that there is a compelling public interest in seeing that our commercial corridors, which are primarily businesses that are owned and operated by people of color and indigenous people, by immigrants, there is a compelling public interest in ensuring that these areas are not totally destroyed and unrecognizable after this civil unrest. And so that's the distinction, and that's why this bill is necessary, is because it really is lifting up the reality that economic development in communities who have been excluded from traditional economic development is actually in the public interest. It is a public use.
Okay, Representative Albright had a question, is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a couple follow-ups.
Does couple mean two, and can you put them together, compound?
I guess I'm back to my first question, though. I didn't hear the answer to my first question. And that is, I'm seeking to know, just to confirm, is it presently against the law what using eminent domain in this fashion as a result? And I think, Mr. Chair, you were probably in office when the law was passed, because I do distinctly remember the Supreme Court ruling, and I was adamantly frustrated. And it wasn't a case that Mr. McGrath cited, because it probably wasn't something his firm covered, but I recall when the in Bloomington, the Walzer parking lot, the used car lot, I think it was, or new car lot, was taken by the city of Richfield and repurposed and given to Best Buy so they could build three buildings, completely and adamantly an abuse of power. And so I remember the outrage after the Supreme Court ruling, and I do remember when this law in Minnesota was passed to prohibit such a use in the future. So my question is the language before us an attempt to create a carve-out in direct opposition to what Minnesotans believe to be an abuse of private confiscation of private property to give to another private owner?
Well, that sounds like a rhetorical question, Representative Lucero. Okay.
Well, no, I'm asking, is it, I'm just trying to, okay, it's not rhetorical, and I'm genuinely asking because I don't know the answer. Is it against the law right now, and is this language that's being proposed because it's currently against the law?
Representative Gomez, can you answer that? Is some of this in reaction to the law we passed that was in reaction to the Best Buy thing?
I mean, if you're asking me about my intent, then no. My intent here is to give my city tools to be able to respond to a human tragedy, the likes of which I don't believe that our state has ever seen. It's not an attempt to circumvent anything. It's an attempt to give cities tools that they need to respond to this unrest. And so, I mean, I think that I kind of covered it, that the standard of public use or public purpose is generally interpreted not to include economic development. And I'm saying that this is an extraordinary circumstance. I understand this is an extraordinary use of a tool that is very powerful, but also that, you know, please come check it out. It's like incidents require a proportional response. This is, I am asking for an extraordinary use of a tool in response to an extraordinary tragedy that's been visited on my district. And, I think that I definitely understand the concerns about eminent domain, and I agree that it needs to be used judiciously. But what we have right now in these commercial corridors is people coming through with cash to people who have experienced trauma, who have lost everything, who don't have support, who are underinsured, who aren't sure what the future is going to look like. And they're saying, oh yeah, hey, this building that's worth a mill, like I'll give you $300,000 for it right now. And that's a very appealing proposition. And so the Promise Act is intended to help stabilize these really delicate commercial districts that are super important to, you know, to the economic security of our entire state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, then I'll ask my last question.
Go ahead, Representative Zero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, Representative Gomez, I absolutely understand that. As a former city council member myself, I very much understand the need for industrial property, business-related property, and the economic benefits that obviously such districts create, absolutely. The concern that I would have is, how is the value going to be determined? because we now have the value prior to a building being burned down, for example, and then you have the value of the building after it's been burned down. And so is the city going to come in now and say, you know, we're going to give you the present post-fire value? And then is that not going to put these private property owners in a significant position of disadvantage? Then the so that's one question. And then a corollary to that is, I was the victim on some of my properties of a hailstorm last fall, or last late summer, I guess it would be. And the nature of insurance claims is they don't give you all the money up front. They depending on the policy and depending on the type of disaster that was suffered, you only get a portion, in this case of hail, you get a portion of the, let's see, what is it, the undepreciated value of the roof, and then you only get the depreciated value of the roof after it's been repaired. And so in this case, if there's a building owner who's had their building burned down, are there going to be policies where the private property owner will not be able to be made whole, because under this language in the city, it's going to prevent the private property owner from rebuilding their building, therein resulting in the insurance company with an excuse to not make the private property owner whole?
Okay, well, I'm not sure if Representative Gomez can answer that question about how it's going to affect what insurance companies do. But if you can, Representative Gomez, go ahead.
I don't know a ton about commercial insurance or the interaction there. I don't know if a researcher can speak to the process for valuation of property, because that was sort of the first question. We have deployed, you know, representatives of the Department of Commerce to come to our district. Representative Dean is carrying a bill that's part of the Promise Act that addresses, you know, what Representative Lucero, what you're identifying is the really complex interaction of different sort of like mechanisms that exist both in the public and private sectors when you experience devastation of this level of physical property. If you want information about the specific process of valuation, I think that's actually a really good question. I will consult with House Research and get back to you on that, because, you know, like, we are also dealing with that in the tax realm of, you know, sort of like, what valuation do you use for the purposes of property taxes, and is there a way to kind of give some favor to some of these businesses as they try to recover. So I'm happy to follow up with you about the interactions between the property valuation and the insurance issues and this temporary and geographically restrained extension of eminent domain that I'm proposing.
Okay, we've got Representative Cantrell, Representative Liebling, and then we're gonna move to a vote. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Gomez, for your work on this bill. Kind of to some of the narrative, I think, that Mr. McGrath has mentioned and that a couple others have talked about, you know, and you've mentioned this as well, Representative Gomez, these are extraordinary circumstances. Your community has been facing something that is entirely unique, is something that is traumatic. And can you maybe say just a little bit about how this bill that you're carrying in particular is really, and this is my impression of the bill, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to ensure that opportunistic developers don't come in and change the entire culture and makeup of your community, you know, something that is intrinsically your community, that's what's on the line. Is that a correct interpretation? And if you just want to talk a little bit about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. And if you could, Representative Gomez, in your answer, be brief. I know you have to be in the next hearing and we're a little bit over time on this as well too. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cantrell, I think that's accurate. I kind of talked about the, you know, that sort of balance of the ecosystem that we need in our business corridors, and that, you know, if we do have speculators kind of coming through and scooping up property and sitting on it until they're ready to make a big profit on it, that actually doesn't serve the needs of the communities that I represent. It does not help the business owners who have been impacted by this, and you know, I don't think that that allowing that to happen, you know, is in alignment with the values that I have, and that I think that I saw and heard expressed by so many representatives that visited the district in their desire to help the existing business owners.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I know Representative Albright had his hand up too, so we're gonna call Representative Albright and then we'll move to a vote. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Okay, well, thank you. I mean, Representative Cantrell kind of went there for me a little bit. I understanding the importance of what you're talking about, I'm just still a little bit unclear of how this tool would be used in this instance. And I mean, I'm understanding, I think, what the goal is here. And I'm just wondering, I mean, maybe you sort of addressed it and we can talk offline, but I feel like I need to understand more about the specifics of how this would be used to accomplish what you want to accomplish. So I think we all agree would be, most of us probably agree, is the right goal, but whether this is the right tool, I'm just a little bit unsure about that. But anyway, we can talk more later. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomez, I was one of those, and we talked specifically that about a couple Saturdays ago. And mind you, my comments are in no way to be shrouded in an unwillingness to support your community. But coming from a business background, I want to caution you that I think your intentions, although very well, focused, they're running headlong into the reality of the Commerce Clause. Because what you're suggesting is that you're disengaging a willing buyer and a willing seller from one another in a private transaction. The eminent domain provision suggests that a municipality or a public entity can purchase private property for the sake of redevelopment and redeploy it without, in as to Mr. McGrath's notes, just compensation. And I think Representative Lucero said it well in terms of who goes about making that appraisal? Is it pre-event or the current depreciated value, as some might suggest? I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair, and if you'll indulge me. The first one is on a couple of different sections. It talks about this redevelopment plan. And could you just explain to us who is going to establish and develop that redevelopment plan?
Representative Gomez? I'm assuming the city.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. The city has assembled, I can't remember what they're calling it, but basically, you know, a group of stakeholders that is, has been tasked with developing short, medium, long-term strategies for the reconstruction of the corridor that's in charge of, developing kind of guiding goals and values, which, as I've been out in the community, certainly include some of the things that I've been talking about this afternoon in terms of, sort of like maintaining and restoring the businesses that are there and not displacing people.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Gomez, on line 2.7, I think this goes to a lot of the concerns that have been raised and addressed to you. It says, may be sold to private parties. But that private party might be someone that didn't own the property before, but has an inability that the eminent domain is almost like that individual that's coming with $300,000 in cash and saying, we're going to buy your property because, the current owner is under extreme duress. regardless of the valuation and or if it's a public entity or a private entity, they may just want to get out. But it may also be premature for them to sell that property because they haven't considered what their insurance valuation may be in terms of a reimbursement against insurance policy and or financing it themselves. And so the timeline that you specify here, getting this all done within the next year and a half, I think that even though that's some, to some that might seem like a lot of time, that is not a very long time for the wheels of commerce and appraisal and eminent domain to work through these things. And so while your intentions are good, I think that the eminent domain function, as has been said by a number, I think that you should seriously reconsider other alternatives. In the vein that this is, I could not support it. So thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Albright?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no other questions from members of committee, is there anyone else on who's going to be testifying to this? I don't see any, so that we will move to a vote on Representative Moeller's motion. I think it was my motion. It was Representative Moeller's motion on the amendment. So on House File 80, as amended, the Committee Legislative Assessment will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Moeller.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan.
Yes.
Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Knorr.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
On a vote of 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. The bill, as amended, is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Gomez. The next bill we have up on the agenda is House File 83.
Mr. Chair?
Who's that?
Lucero.
Representative Lucero, go ahead.
Hey, I appreciate it. I wanted to give these remarks before we started the committee meeting, but I just wanted to thank your CA, Rachel Ganani, for just the tremendous job that she's been doing here with most recent and today's committee hearings, just getting information out. I very much, as a member of the minority, I know you can appreciate that we don't get as information as fast as the majority does, obviously. But Rachel has just been great. Just timing the emails. And then one of the things I really appreciate is on the website, the committee website, the thorough documentation of which amendment is associated with which bill, and then also including the PDFs and the emails that she's sending out. It just really is incredibly helpful. So I just a big kudos to her. So thank you.
Well, Representative Sarah, I'll make sure I note that in her next review, the committee CA should not be helping members of the minority. I'm kidding. No, Rachel, great job. Excellent. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for pointing that out, Representative Lucero. She does do a great job, and we're very grateful for her expertise and fairness and objectivity on this. Let's move on to House File 83, Representative Hassan. The bill is providing assistance to residential and commercial tenants in areas of civil unrest. Representative Hassan is a member of the committee, moves that House File 83 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Hassan, can you tell us about your bill?
I can unmute myself, of course. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. 2020 has been a heck of a year. We witnessed a pandemic that closed our malls, restaurants, shops, gyms, and everything else, followed by an unjust murder of George Floyd in the hands of Minneapolis police. Then the civil unrest that burned down many small businesses in our communities. The impacted businesses were predominantly owned by Black and Brown folks who had a tough year because of COVID-19. I have the privilege and honor to represent District 62A and Lake Street, which sustained a lot of damage from fire, water, or other forms of destruction, happens to be in the heart of my district. This is sad and traumatic for many in my in our communities, as we find a way to comprehend everything that took place in the last few weeks. I must highlight that the root cause of the civil unrest, which was not about one man being killed by the police. The civil unrest was about economic justice, social justice, and racial justice. Black, indigenous, and people of color in this country have been faced with systemic oppression that's as old as America itself. We were caught in the middle of two pandemics, COVID-19 and racial inequities that left many people in Black and Brown communities behind. Nonetheless, many of you have visited these areas and heard from owners who were in great pain and grieving the loss of everything they have worked for. On behalf of my community, I want to sincerely thank you for making the trip to see it for yourself. These folks, there were some folks who had stores 27 plus years and others who just opened their store right before COVID-19. During the last few weeks, we listened to our community, heard their voices on what rebuilding looks like. There has been a lot of concern about gentrification and displacement. Everyone is worried about newer buildings, which means higher rent, which means most of these tenants who are small business owners won't be able to afford. People are worried that there are going to be newer buildings, which means Starbucks, Trader Joe's, and other expensive stores that many in my community will not be able to shop. This discussions about gentrification led to the birth of House File 83. House File 83 is an act relating to housing, providing assistance to residential and commercial tenants in the areas of impacted by the civil unrest. This bill caps the rent for both commercial and residential properties that are eligible for or who receive state funding related to damage and fire during the civil unrest in May and June. This bill does limit rent for those properties to the average rent in the first quarter of 2020, which is January, February, or March, or the last annual payment if rent is paid annually. This bill provides a residential tenant with enforcement provisions if this section is violated using existing tenant remedies and provisions. The rent restriction affects new and renewed leases after July 1st, 2020, and this lasts until April 1st of 2024. The property owners can increase rent annually during this period based on inflation. With that, I have a couple testifiers and I'll stand for questions. I hope you can support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Representative Hassan, I understand that you have several testifiers. The first I see is Swad Hassan. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Swad A. Hassan.
Go ahead, Ms. Hassan.
I'm sorry, I'm having connection problems. Bear with me. We've owned a business on Lake Street for over 20 years. In the past decade, we have seen many ways of changes take place on Lake Street. As the majority of minority own Lake Street on businesses, it seems like there's been somewhat of gentrifications. We've seen many landlords increase rents greatly in the past months. This has caused loss of many Native Americans and immigrants and Black and Brown-owned businesses to close. These business owners are the backbone of their community. They offer products and services that the Main Street or the Fortune 500 companies don't. These services contribute to the state and often are undervalued and unnoticed. These services are products that are not found. And as someone who owns and operates on Lake Street for the past years, it's been tough at times. While landlord collects the checks for damages done to the buildings, even when coronavirus is going on and there's not many businesses, most of these landlords continue to collect money. Most business owners are barely making ends meet. Discriminated and insurance settlements, the lack of business due to the civil unrest have made it nearly impossible for small businesses to continue to thrive. Businesses like us to operate on Lake Street. City of Minneapolis has decided to whether or not to value all its citizens in Minneapolis. Families are making decision whether to pay for rent or whether to keep their doors open. With the increase of the light on Lake Street, landlord will use this opportunity to further their benefits. Already high rents, leaving businesses with no choice but to walk away. Once they do this, they will take their place. How will the Main Street vibrant diversity of our city continue to thrive? We ask that the city to place a cap on rent, giving these marginalized community of color a chance to get back on their feet. We ask the city to place a red tape on resale to ensure that minority of Minneapolis have a priority in sales. We ask the city to place protection on landlord to not evict any owners for late payments, rent during this terminal heartaches that's going on. We ask the city to provide relief funds directly to business owners and not the landlord who will still be receiving rent. If the Minneapolis is truly for increasing its engagement in Black and Brown and Native Americans and immigrant community, then they need to start here at Lake Street, where the life of an innocent Black man was taken, bright daylight. Now the rest of us are in desperate and are in holding of our great Minnesotans to help out. Please do the right thing and act before it's too late. Our landlord has been collecting rent regardless whether we are operating and making sales or not. This makes it very difficult for us to continue to strive and be successful. Thank you for listening to my concern, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hassan. Aide Vasquez.
Sí, buenas tardes.
Hello, everyone.
Mi nombre es Aide Vasquez.
My name is Aide Vasquez.
Yo tengo en el negocio 16 años. Mi negocio está localizado dentro del Mercado Central.
My business is in Mercado Central, and it's 116.
16 años en el negocio.
She has been there for 16 years.
Pues ahora la preocupación mía es muy grande.
Right now I'm very worried.
Porque cerramos los negocios desde marzo.
Because I have had my job closed since COVID, so since March.
Ya cuando teníamos quizás muchos de los negociantes un poco de dinero como invertir para poner las cabinas para protegernos del COVID.
Once we all came, got a little bit of money and was able to put the COVID protection.
Pues nos pasa lo de los saqueos.
Was where all this hacking came.
Estoy realmente preocupada porque ya son casi 4 meses sin poder trabajar y la renta sigue subiendo.
I'm very concerned and worried because since all of this went down, they're raising up the rent and I don't have money.
queremos, muchos de los comerciantes latinos queremos seguir adelante.
A lot of us, the Latino community, want to continue and proceed.
Pero no tenemos el capital para continuar.
But we don't have the capability to actually succeed.
Necesitamos el apoyo de ustedes.
We need you guys to help out.
Porque de cualquier manera somos conscientes que movemos la economía de Ley Street.
Because regardless of anything, we know that we are there and we are helping Lake Street grow.
Y de estos negocios es que muchos de nosotros sacamos nuestras familias adelante.
With a lot of these stores and on Lake Street.
I think we may have lost you, Ms. Vasquez.
All this to actually help their families successfully. Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, yes, we can hear you now. Proceed, right. I'm sorry.
All right. Entonces, ¿qué dijiste antes de eso?
Que necesitamos la ayuda urgente.
We need help urgently.
Habemos muchas familias pasando necesidades económicas.
There's a lot of families like ours having finance problems.
No tenemos cómo pagar la universidad de mi hija.
I don't know how I'm going to pay for my daughter's university.
Entonces, por favor, ayúdenos a activar rápido para que vuelva a activarse la E-Street y sigamos luchando.
So please help us out. Give us a hand so that we could come together and we can actually succeed.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Vasquez. Eloy Bravo.
Hola, muy buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Eloy Bravo. Llegué a Estados Unidos hace 36.
I came, momentito, ya, podemos mute, ¿verdad? So my name, good afternoon, my name is Eloy Bravo. I came approximately 35 years ago to the United States. Continúa hablando, señor. I came to New York City 35 years ago. And 16 years ago, I took made the decision to come here to Minnesota. I came here on vacations, and I loved it. I fell in love with the state, with its people. And then 16 years ago, my wife and my children and I started a small business, a salon, a beauty salon. During 16 years, we have been working very hard. 3 weeks ago, a Thursday morning, I received a phone call. And someone say that my business was destroyed. So I came along with my family. We went to the place. And when I saw the devastation in the place, my heart and my soul were broken. To see 16 years of our work, our hard work, our effort, all on the ground, wasted. Everything was destroyed. Everything was vandalized. So I want to request and ask you to please help us. Help us. We don't want to leave Lake Street. Lake Street for me is one of the most beautiful things that I have seen since I came to this state. So I don't want us to oust us over there for cause of the rent are going to be up and higher. And I am requesting you your help so we can reconstruct our businesses, so we can reconstruct Lake Street. And beforehand, I want to say thank you very much to all of you from the Latino families, from people that work very hard with me, because they also have families to support. They also have their own expenses. So we want to work hard again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. God bless you all.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bravo. We are going to skip direct testimony from Mr. Elwood, but he is the subject matter expert. And he will remain here for questions if members have them. So are there questions from members of the committee for House File 83? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I would have for the bill author is, when I'm looking at line 1.21, it talks about calculating the consumer price index for all urban consumers. What is the scope to calculate that index? Is that the street, Lake Street? Is that the city of Minneapolis? Is it seven county metro area? Is it the state as a whole?
I believe it's the metro, seven county metro area, because
I think you're muted, Representative Hassan, or frozen, one or the other.
Can you hear me?
Chair Lesh, I can hear Representative Hassan. I think you were breaking up though, Chair Lesh. I think your connection may not be super solid.
Got it. I'm gonna stop my
video. Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, I believe it's the seven county metro. It's not only Lake Street that was impacted. It's not only City of Minneapolis that was impacted. City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, and other surrounding suburbs, some of them were impacted. So I believe it's the seven county metro.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so that being the case, so we're going to use inflation and other variables to calculate the consumer price index of the entire seven county metro area. That's going to include counties that were not impacted, that may have different variables that have an impact on price increases or decreases that have nothing and no association with the very limited and focused area of a particular street and the immediate surrounding areas in the city of Minneapolis. I'm concerned with that because what if there was a new cost? Because I see on the last line of the bill that this is in effect until April 1st of 2024. What if there are localized expenses that the property owner, the landlord, has to now incur that aren't reflected in the broader calculation for the CPI of the seven county metro area? One example, I have a commercial building that its lease, my lease with my tenant, expired April 30th of 2020. Right, so literally 6 weeks or so ago. And I had to renew the lease on May 1st. So that would be in scope of the lease that you're talking about here. And my lease was for 2 years, and so I'd have to calculate using the rent paid by my tenant for the months or the year prior. But since the last time we signed the lease, we've had a significant tax increase because there was a school levy that was passed. And I'm sure you're probably aware that school levies disproportionately impact commercial industrial property than they do residential property. So what you're saying is I would have to incur, I as a landlord would have to absorb that significant cost increase, and I couldn't factor that into passing that along to the cost of my tenant. Is that correct?
Representative Hassan?
I want to correct one thing first. You keep saying that one street and a city of Minneapolis. This impacted areas are not one street. It's not the city of Minneapolis alone. The city of St. Paul has many damages, and there are other cities that have damage. So I want to correct that for the record. And then I also want to ask Mary Mullen to maybe clarify the answer for Representative Lucero, because she was the one that helped me craft this bill.
Can you answer that, Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, a few people are blinking out and I can't really hear them, but I believe the question is sort of why the consumer price index for urban areas is being used. That is a common way of calculating inflation, both in Minnesota's statute and in the entire country. So we use it in a wide variety of ways in statute, including in taxes and in other areas. So it's a pretty common thing for Minnesota statute.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Ms. Mullen. But that wasn't my question at all. My question is, when calculating inflation, it's not going to take into account very specific cost increases that a landlord may incur. And the example I'm citing is, we had a school levy pass in our area that impacts only the commercial industrial property and residential property and other property in the school district. And that well exceeds 2.5%, 2.25% inflation. And if I'm understanding the bill correctly, I'm, as a landlord, would only be able to increase my rent to inflation that is calculated across the 7-county metro area, but doesn't take into consideration localized events where my cost increase could well exceed the cost of inflation. So what am I supposed to do as a landlord? My question is, what do I do because I can't raise the rent and it may put me in the red?
Ms. Mullen, did you get that question? And yeah. Can you answer that?
Chair and members, this bill does limit the rent to an increase that only would take into calculation the inflation. And that would be the only rent increase allowed until April of 2024. So for a period of time, whatever other reasons a landlord might have for increasing rent, it wouldn't go beyond the inflation percentage.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that answers it. So if I incur costs that exceed the calculated CPI, I am not able to increase the rent. So essentially, I'm being forced by this bill to rent property to my tenant at a loss. How is that economically sustainable? And this goes on for 4 years. I can't believe that we're going to, you're saying the government has the authority, hey, private property owner, not only are we going to confiscate your property or threaten to, right, through eminent domain, but now even if we choose not to, we're going to force you to rent it out at a loss. You know what I would do? I would shut the building down and I would evict my tenants. And that's going to have the exact opposite impact. Why? I just don't understand the rationale behind this whatsoever. The last question I would have, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author is, how do you think that is economically viable?
Well, Representative Hassan, if you want to, I mean, it's a rhetorical question, of course. Answer accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lucero, mind you, there are people who have lost over decades worth of investment, people who have lost everything that they have owned, that have nothing today. Not a single thing that they own. And what we're doing here, it might upset you because it doesn't impact you, but it impacts me. It impacts the people that I represent. And if this was you, if you were the representative for District 62 or any of the districts that are impacted, I am sure you will take drastic change to make sure that your community gets help that they need. You have heard people cry their heart out saying that, please help us. We lost everything. We have lost everything. I hope those words, you know, echoed in your somewhere. We are trying to make sure that Lake Street stays Lake Street, that University Avenue stays University Avenue, that West Broadway stays West Broadway. We want to make sure that the people that are impacted by the civil unrest do not get gentrified. Do not get displaced. And if that's upsetting to you, I'm really sorry. There's nothing I can do.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hassan, let me paint a question for you. So on Lake Street, if a proprietor's building burnt down, and to replace that building costs 25% more based upon upgrading to the current code, to the regulatory environment that the city would, you know, have to enforce on that new building. It costs 25% more than what the appraised value of the building was. They have to take out a mortgage to pay for that and finance the building, rebuilding of their business. And let's say they sublet it out and lease it out to tenants. What you're suggesting is that they cannot transfer or obligate their leases to finance, help finance that new mortgage. So under that context, and in conjunction with Representative Gomez's bill, if I were either a current building owner in downtown Lake Street or was considered of buying a property in downtown Minneapolis on Lake Street, I wouldn't buy. It's not economically feasible, Representative Hassan. You are imposing on either an existing incumbent property owner who needs to rebuild or someone that would come in and purchase the property with every intention of keeping the flavor and character of Lake Street. You are making them face an impossible economic decision that they cannot overcome. It is not economical to perpetuate this in either House File 80 or 83. You are doing the exact opposite of what you hope to achieve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I don't see anyone else on the list. Members, if we don't finish by 6:10, we get kicked off and can't finish the committee work until after 8 tonight. But I see no one else on the list for this, no other committee discussion either. We will move to a vote. The committee, the motion is that House File 83 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Moeller.
Yes.
Representative Scott. Representative Scott. Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine. Representative Considine. Representative Hassan. Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Noor.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
On a vote of 10 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. House File 83 is referred to Ways and Means. Representative Noor has the next bill, House File 90, and this establishes a special master panel to make awards to compensate for damages, similar to what we did for 35W. Rep Noor, as the member of the committee, moves that House File 90 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. You have an A1 author amendment, puts the bill in the shape the author so desires. Rep Noor, would you like to explain the A1 amendment very briefly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment places the amount of $125 million for the for the compensation, and also $5 million for the administration fee. It also addresses the need for the administration to determine, the commissioner to determine the amount of compensation based on the need.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions as to the amendment, so we will take a vote on the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no.
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 The motion prevails. To your bill as amended, I see you have one testifier, Matt Ayling with Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Mr. Ayling, can you just very briefly state your testimony on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'll briefly summarize the written comments that we have and we'll take questions. I did get a chance to speak with Representative Noor this morning and appreciate his listening to our concerns about the bill. We are suggesting changes that you'll see in our written comments that pertain to the data practices and meetings section in Subdivision 8. As members are aware, from our past appearances before this committee, we try to ensure that there's uniformity across government entities in regard to data practices and open meeting law application, whether they're police departments or special commissions such as this one. So if you look at Subdivision 8, our first concern is that the data practices language essentially classifies most of the data that would be created by this panel as not public data. It says at line 5.4, data collected, created, or maintained by the panel related to a claim is essentially private data on individuals. And since the full purpose of this panel is to adjudicate these claims, that essentially touches every piece of data or almost every piece of data generated by the panel, thus making it not public. The open meeting law provision that we'd like to see changed is at line 5.13, which specifies that meetings of this panel are not subject to the open meeting law. So what we've suggested instead, if you look at our written comments, is that the language be changed so that only the claim data submitted by individuals and businesses and nonprofits is classified. The rest of the data, which would pertain to minutes and meetings, meeting minutes, memos generated by the panel to document how it conducted its operations, would be public. And we provided a couple of cross-references to existing provisions of the Data Practices Act that classify data on public benefits provided to businesses and individuals. In regards to the Chapter 13D open meeting law provisions, our suggestions change that to the application of the open meeting law to this panel. I would note for members that the panel, the open meeting law under its existing composition does permit otherwise open meetings to be closed momentarily for the discussion of sensitive medical data or mental health data or other sensitive data on individuals. So to the extent there's concerns over testimony provided by members of the public seeking claims or submitting claims that stray into sensitive areas, those could be temporarily closed. But the bulk of the panel's deliberations would be public if you apply the open meeting law. And that benefits everyone, those who are submitting claims, the press who's trying to track this process of the distribution of this large amount of money, and other members of the public. So those are the suggestions we made to Representative Noor, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. This committee has always taken very seriously concerns put forward by the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, and it's my hope that Representative Noor will work with you on this as we move forward. It is my intent to support the bill today as is, with that caveat, in the hope that we can get to that point where it addresses those concerns. Other questions or statements from members of the committee? Seeing none, then we will move to a vote.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I raised my hand real late. And this is a legal question, and I perhaps might ask it directly of you. But on line 5.11, it says the context data created by the member, by a member of the panel related to member service as a member of the panel are not discoverable in any civil or administrative proceeding. This may sound naive, Mr. Chair, but can we prohibit that?
Well, Representative Albright, in my experience and recollection, that's an open question. Because that is a procedural question, that is a procedural matter for the courts, and the courts and legislative branches have battled over jurisdiction on procedure versus substance for years. Courts have usually won on procedure, and legislatures have usually won on substance. So it's my expectation that if this were litigated on due process grounds, that that it probably would be discoverable. But honestly, I haven't looked at the case law on this in a couple of years. Just my opinion. Maybe research has a better answer for us on that.
Could I ask them to weigh in on that?
And sure.
Not to hold them I can hold them harmless, but I certainly think that for the benefit of the committee, that would be appreciable.
Sure. Is Ms. Muller, Mr. Johnson, or anyone want to weigh in on that?
Mr. Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins with House Research. I do believe there are other places in statute where we make certain data not discoverable in civil proceedings. This is related to the fact that there are immunity provisions for the board or panel members under this statute. So the idea is that they wouldn't be subject to civil litigation about the awards that are being created and given under this statute. So in conjunction with that immunity from suit, they're also immune from being subject to discovery when it comes to documents and other things created as a result. I think that your answer was on point with regard to if someone were to bring a lawsuit and try to request information through discovery, it would be up to the court, I think, to determine whether or not they would be able to access the documents under the statute.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr and I had the occasion of sharing a good part of state government finance earlier today, discussing the merits of House File then 89. I understand this is a clone of the same, so I don't have any further questions. Representative Knorr has received made a response to me, and I'll wait for Ways and Means before I follow up with him. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Representative Knorr. I'm sorry I didn't have the benefit of the earlier hearing, so forgive me if this is redundant, but I have some concerns about the immunity provisions in and the indemnification in Subdivision 7 and then also in relationship to other law in Section 4. And so I'm wondering, are other panels given such broad immunity and indemnification? And what is the purpose of Subdivision 1 in line 5.25 through 5.30? Thank you.
Reps, I'm sorry, that question was for the author?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the issue of immunity and indemnification has been addressed. This is similar to what has been created before, and it also addresses the need to ensure that the panel have that security for them to do the work that is necessary to provide expeditious services and also to address the need that exists on many of the areas that have been impacted. The second question I didn't hear clearly. What was the segment that you are referring to?
Representative Robbins.
I'm sorry. Subdivision 1 in Section 4, it's lines 5.25 to 5.30. I'm wondering why, how you're tying this to, is it an attempt to indemnify the state or the city? Or why is this necessary?
Representative Nora.
So I think I will defer this to the council to explain that segment of the bill.
Mr. Hopkins?
Mr. Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins with House Research. So normally state employees enjoy a number of, and state entities enjoy a number of immunities from suit. Under statute and under common law. Statutory immunity under Minnesota statutes section 3.736 protects planning level or policy making activity from suits, includes decisions that are made that weigh various political, social, or financial factors. And it basically means that decisions that are made by a government entity or a government official that involve that kind of planning level and policy making activity, which weighs financial factors, are protected from suit under that statute. So what this section of the bill is doing is making it clear that the actions of this panel are protected by existing statutory immunity that applies normally to state entities and to the officials as individuals that are working in their official capacity for them.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So just one more clarification. The last sentence, the creation and funding of the compensation process under this act is not admissible in a judicial or administrative proceeding to establish liability or a legal duty. So if someone sues the city or the state for decisions made that caused the damage, these decisions regarding awarding under this provision would not be able to be admissible in terms of amount of damage or what was found as the assessment. Is that a correct reading of this?
Mr. Hopkins?
Representative Robbins, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question then from Chair Johnson, then we're gonna move to a vote. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members. Representative Knorr, I got a couple minor questions. One is I'm concerned about, I was dealing with some issues when the amendment was taken up, so I didn't get to ask them. I had some technical difficulties here. I'm in greater Minnesota where we don't have the high-speed internet like everybody else does. But I'm concerned with the dollar amount. You have $130 million. 125 going out for the to the individuals that for grants and stuff. I have 5 million for operating administrator it. The state, to me, that seems a little high for doing this. And I'd rather get that, if we're going to do that, get the 5 million to the people that need it. But my concern is how you came up with that fund, $125 million. Minneapolis, I will admit, got the worst of the damage of the riots. But Mayor Fry only requested $55 million from the federal government to cover the cost of the damage. So it makes me wonder if we end up with $55 million from the federal government, and that's all the mayor requested, why do we have to do another $130?
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Is that to Representative Knorr?
That is, this is his bill.
Go ahead, Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, this is part of the Promise Act bill. This is a comprehensive recovery package for the people who've been impacted after the death of George Floyd in the hands of Minneapolis police.
Mr. Chair, I take exception to this comment. It was not the Minneapolis Police Department, it was one individual. I'm getting tired of lumping every single law enforcement officer in this state into one thing because one person did something. Sure. Yesterday, the day before, we had State Paul, the Chair State Paul officers shot and they're rioting there because the cop wasn't killed.
Chair Johnson, your comments are noted for the record. You are out of order. Please be respectful.
I admit I was out of order. It's just getting very frustrating lumping the entire, every police officer in the same category as what one bad apple that should not have been a law enforcement officer did.
Representative Knorr, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, what is really frustrating is when you see black men who are killed by police, but that's not the discussion here. We're talking about racial inequity that exists. We have seen the devastation that happened in Minneapolis because of we were not there to help those businesses. Quite frankly, $55 million, that was a misstatement in the paper. They need to understand when more than 1,500 businesses have been impacted, mostly black and brown and indigenous people. Whenever it happens in somewhere else, I think we come up with the resources that is needed. But when it comes to helping addressing the structural issue, the economic inequities that exist in our state, $125 million, it's not something significant. I think we can address the underlying issues, and this is one of them. So I think what we need to look into is how do we uplift the lives and the livelihood of the people who have been impacted in the state of Minnesota? Look at the inequities. We spend billions of dollars. In fact, it's going to cost billions to rebuild and bring back to Lake Street and many parts of the city back to where it was because of failures of government. We have to admit we failed the people of Minneapolis. We failed the people of St. Paul. It's our obligation. It's our duty. It's our promise that we need to stand with those families who are making their livelihood. And this bill addresses one component of it, and we need to look into the sections that we're supposed to be dealing with on the data practice and the immunity sections, but not overall goal. I think we'll have that conversation in ways and means once this bill goes there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The motion from Representative Knorr is that House File 90, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesch.
Chair votes aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott. Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan.
Yes.
Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Knorr.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
While we're waiting for the vote, I will tell members that I put my video back on. If I get choppy again, someone please let me know, and I will just revert to audio again. On a vote of 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 90, as amended, is referred to Ways and Means. The last file we have up is House File 97, Representative Kunesh Padin. We are only dealing with the data section of this bill. It modifies private data disclosures to include tribal nations. I move that House File 97 be recommended to be placed in the general register. Representative Kunesh Padin is here. We have 4 minutes before the feed is shut down and we are no longer an active committee. So if that does in fact happen, committee will be in recess to the call of the chair. Representative Kanesh Padin.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Chair. This bill very simply will allow access to data that pertains to our American Indian students. It will allow tribes to be able to advocate on behalf of their students to determine federal and local funding, budget usages, support and strengthen budget justifications, allocate resources, provide services, conduct strategic planning, and comply with statutory and regulatory reporting processes. Especially, it brings it, it allows school districts to come in alignment with ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, where states are mandated to work with tribes on behalf of the students. And we need this bill to allow the school districts and the tribes to share the information so that our American Indian students are able to have the resources and the support that they need to succeed.
Thank you for that, Representative Kanesh Padin. Representative Albright.
Representative Kanesh Padin, lines 3.21 to lines 3.23 are the body of what is changed here. I have a community in my district as well that this would pertain to. Could you please explain to me how we are changing state law and its effect upon a sovereign entity?
Representative Kanesh Padin.
Well, right now, let me think for a minute here. There's a component here where I'm going to ask Adosh, if you are there, if you could explain this, because I'm in such a hurry, I'm not getting it clear in my mind. So if districts don't identify the tribal nations as a volunteer with a legitimate educational interest, and since they're not explicitly on the list of entities that can have data shared with them, parents then would consent to the data being shared with the tribes, and they would have access to that information.
Why don't I save you from the frustration, Representative Kanesh Padin? I don't mean to drive you that hard here. We are going to have to come back to this. There's 1 minute left before the feed cuts us off. And I expect Chair Scott has some questions about the data provision of this as well. We're not going to be able to complete it. So I am going to hold us now. And for now, committee is in recess to the call. The House Judiciary and Civil Law Committee is called back to order. The order of business that we were last on is House File 97, Representative Kanesh Padin had deferred to Adosh Uni, and I apologize if I'm butchering your name, please correct me, regarding the most recent question posed by I can't remember whom. But if you wanted to just pick up from there, Representative Kanesh Padin, if you wanted to take a different direction, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to start over and set the stage for this bill. You know, my three-sentence introduction, I don't think, gave quite the overview that I was hoping to. So I'd like to just start over and begin it again, and perhaps some of those questions that folks have will be a little clearer, and then we'll go on from there. Sound good?
Excellent. Go ahead. Please proceed.
So on behalf of the Office of Indian Education and at the request of the Tribal Nations Education Committee, this bill is before you in order to allow for better compliance with the federal ESSA, which is the Every Student Succeeds Act, where districts and charter schools are supposed to, by federal law, to engage in timely and meaningful tribal consultation around education plans created under the Title VI funds and the requirements. There are several required consultation topics that are necessary for the sharing of student data with our tribal nations, such as achievement based from assessments, helping with truancy, discipline, post-secondary opportunities and a lot of other ways that they're able to support the families and the students. But the problem is that since tribal nations are not explicitly on the list of entities and uses which districts and charters can share private education data, and that's in Minnesota Statute 13.32, Subdivision 3, districts and charter schools are not able to share the data with tribes. So as you can imagine, there is a critical need for accurate, meaningful, and timely data information for American Indian students. And of course, without that, it impedes our immediate meaningful consultation as the governor has instructed us to do with our tribes. So with the access to data that pertains to our American Indian students, tribes will finally be able to advocate on behalf of their students, to determine federal and funding budget usages, support and strengthen budget justifications, allocate resources, provide services, conduct strategic planning, and comply with statutory and regulatory reporting processes. And so I think we can all agree how important accurate data collection is, and community-based planning definitely captures the true needs of our American Indian students. So House File 97 can drive larger programmatic investments that result in cost-efficient uses of tribal, federal, and private resources. Without this quality data, policymakers and community, and when I say policymakers, that's us, even in, like, I'm on the education committee. We need that data. Without that data, we have nothing, you know, to start from, to work with, to see where the disparities are or where issues are that we can create good policy to support our American Indian students. So without that quality data, we legislators and community planners can't set policy goals. We can't monitor implementation or measure impact or plan for demographic shifts in an effective way. The absence of our American Indian students in data and policy domains could very well be one of the reasons that our American Indian students experience the lowest outcomes of our educational system within our state. And so again, the proposal in House File 97 would allow districts and charters to share the data with tribes for legitimate educational purposes without confusion around the law. And that's what it is.
Excellent. Thank you. Well presented, Representative Kadush Bedin.
Pardon me?
Someone is piping in. Who's that?
Mr. Chair, it's Mr. Representative Albright.
Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kanesh Padin, I appreciate starting over. That does give a much better context for the rationale behind this legislation. Is the information that's offered to the tribal community on behalf of the students that would be enrolled in either a charter or an ISD, is that disaggregated data, or is that pertinent to each individual student?
Representative Kanesh Bedin.
I believe it is pertinent to each individual student, because remember that there are 11 tribes in Minnesota alone. And then we've got our neighbors to the north and the south and the west and the east, and those are individual tribes as well. So even though the student might be living, let's say, in New Brighton, Minnesota, they might be an enrolled member of Standing Rock Tribe in South Dakota. And with the information and the resources that enrollment tribe has for that student, they can reach across and say, here are our support systems. If we don't have them, you know, from South Dakota, we know people in Minnesota that can work on this together. And there's also, you know, these the Indian parent committees and communities that are a resource to families and schools. And so it would be individual information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that for the sake of, you know, encouraging the student. But Are we subordinating parental oversight of pertinent personal information about that individual to tribal governance? I know, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions, but in any circumstance, there could be concerns and or information disclosed that would be private to the parent, but not pertinent to the tribal governance structure. How do we prevent that from being used against the student in some type of adverse way? Who is responsible for protecting the student from misuse of that data?
Sure, I can understand that sentiment. And I think another point that I want to make is this very unique relationship that American Indians typically, and I would say the majority of them, have this very unique relationship with their tribes. No matter where they live, the essence of their tribal sovereignty remains with their tribe. And I don't know if you can understand that or believe it, but it's absolutely true. And by treaties, by laws with the federal government, tribal members are citizens of three sovereigns. Their tribe, first of all, then the United States, and then the state in which they reside. They are also individuals in an international context with the right to any other individual. So if they're out of the country, they are a sovereign entity in France or England or Canada. And so the very essence of the tribal affiliation is that ability to govern and to protect and enhance the health, safety, and welfare of their tribal members. And American Indians know this. This is like in their being. So your question is, what about if somebody tries to misuse that kind of information? Well, first of all, there is the ability to create permission or acknowledgement with the school districts when there's an enrollment that happens. Oops, somebody's dog at my head. For example, the Shakopee band, they share information with their school district because they have an agreement with the school districts and the parents sign off on that. So this bill is identifying those tribal nations as like a volunteer group or a group within in the school district where the legitimate, and we're saying legitimate, so scores and things like that. I have a list of things that they can access. If they're not on that list as a volunteer, then the schools don't have to give that information out. And some schools push back and refuse to do that. So tribes can only use identifiable information for legitimate educational purposes. And so in this case, the tribes would use the information to help provide information on how to target support for students, how to fulfill their consultation obligation under federal ESSA. And if that information in summary is non-identifiable, then the tribes can do what they want to do with that information. So if they're misusing it, then they would also be liable. They would be their participation for data security is dictated under Chapter 13 data privacy laws. So, and just like any other school that holds that data information, it's the same responsibility for the tribes.
Representative Albright, you know, and you're asking these questions. I was, I know these questions are, I guess, close to what Chair Scott would often ask too. And I was asked specifically by Chair Scott about trying not to have a hearing on Tuesday if we could. And it's only now that I'm realizing that she's not with us, and that was not certainly intentional. I know this is an area that's important to her, and hopefully, Representative Albright, you're asking some of those questions that Rep. Scott would have asked as well, related to the specific security of data for the kids. So thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I take that as a very high compliment that you would consider that I would ask questions akin to what my esteemed colleague would. I only have a couple more for the representative, and it has to do with, and Representative Kunesh-Badin, everything that you've said makes sense, and I understand that because the Shakopee, Midwaukee, and Sioux community shares that similar relationship with the Prairie Lake Savage School District. I just want to make sure that from a protection standpoint, that data is disseminated with parental approval. And in some cases, as you can understand, the disparate nature of parents, sometimes you get one without the other. And so I just want to make sure, how do we make sure that parental oversight of that data is approved by the parents to each student?
Sure. So, thank you, Chair. And that's a really good piece of information. And again, our school districts hold that information, and what happens if they were to leak that information? There are repercussions. But there are different ways that you can ensure that the parents understand that the tribes are using or accessing that information and using it appropriately. The best thing that you can do in a school district is to build a trusting relationship with those parents. When school starts and there are all those permissions forms to sign for, allowing your kid's picture to be taken, they can go on field trips, they can do this, they can do that, that's another opportunity for it. So it would be probably at the best way is to create that relationship between the tribes and the school districts across the state, with the understanding that there would be some sort of permission to share that data. And if they don't want that data shared, then it would probably end right there.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kunesh-Badin, if I could draw your attention to lines 2.12 through 2.14, and it would relate to what we were just talking about with regard to parental consent. And I don't know about, the nature of, and this is where Chair Lesh is so much better, but it says, except as authorized by law, without the written consent of the parent of the student, and the request and a record of the release are maintained in the student's file. So is the language that you're adding at the back, at the bottom end of this chapter of statute, is that primary to 2.13 through 2.14? Are we subordinating the rights of the parents to the tribe?
And I'm going to ask Mr. Uni to step in here, but if we go back to 3.19, just at the very end before the new language starts, it says, at a minimum, the institution must distribute the information release forms to parent and student orientation meetings or to tribal nations about tribally enrolled. So I don't believe it trumps the other one. I think it's meant to be to work in conjunction with each other. But perhaps Mr. Uni would be able to clarify that a little bit more.
Mr. Uni's chomping at the bit here to give a good answer. He's ready. Go ahead, Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair, Adosh Uni, Government Relations Director with the Department of Education. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a little bit of clarity here. So if you look at the statute in question that's looking to be amended, 13.32, for educational data, it indeed does, under this subdivision 3, allow 17 uses or entities access to private individually identifiable data that is education data without parental consent. So this is 17 different entities. One of those entities that Representative Kunesh Pradeen did identify was a volunteer organization or volunteer individual who has a legitimate educational interest in processing the data to provide support to the school district, provide support to families. And how that's governed is under the disclosure agreements that the districts or charters have with the entity that they're sharing the data with. And that includes parameters around the allowable uses, the strict parameters around the uses, reminders of what the consequences are under state and federal law about abuses of that data. And I think Representative Kunesh Pradeen covered it quite well that it's around specific legitimate educational interests. So the tribes wouldn't be able to gather data every single student in the district. They would be gathering data as defined in the bill, which is a tribally enrolled or descended student of their specific tribe. Additionally, they would be using it for the purposes of the meaningful and substantive consultation under the federal law. So the parameters would be quite tightly written. And some districts, again, as Representative Kunesh Pradeen pointed out, some districts do have a strong relationship with the tribes and currently do consider the tribes under that volunteer exception. But we have an inconsistent application around the state. And so some legal counsel for certain districts are informing their district clients that, you know, this isn't necessarily a volunteer organization. They're not explicitly named. So you shouldn't share the data with them because they're not on the list. So the real problem is we have an inconsistent application around the state, but this wouldn't be creating a new, whole new system where it's circumventing parental consent. It is adding them in as a legitimate partner with legitimate educational interest to 17 other uses and entities.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Uni. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Uni, my follow-up then to you then is, going back to lines 2.12 through 2.14, with all those 17 entities that would be able or privy to the data on a student, are they all availed to that data? And then to include what the initiative at the bottom of 3.21 through 3.23, with or without parental consent?
So
before the data is given to them.
Mr. Oney.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, so the data that any of these entities currently, and if the tribes are added, it would be the same thing. The data that they're privy to is for those narrow purposes that are defined either in that statute for health purposes, for truancy purposes, for post-secondary setting purposes, or for a set of reasons defined in a disclosure agreement, they would be able to have access to that specific set of data for a specific set of students for a specific set of time, and it would be defined in the agreement. They don't necessarily have an ongoing access to data. There are situations, maybe what you're talking about, where there are entities who weren't necessarily on the list, and there do have to be parental consent. Under that requirement, we generally say that that data can be held for about a year, and I think that's under federal law. So there are several routes to go. One, as we were discussing here under the statute, which is explicitly allowed to access data with an agreement with the district. And I do want to say the district and charter is not necessarily under an obligation to share the data with these entities or for these uses. They are allowed to share the data without parental consent. So there's nothing forcing the district or charter to share it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Mr. Uni, so the answer to my previous question is that these entities are availed of the data periodically or intermittently without parental approval. Is there any notice given to the parents at any point in time that their students' data may be shared with these entities from time to time for purposes of compliance with ESSA and other federal programs? Is there any disclosure to the guardians, parents, or supervising entities over a juvenile with regard to their data?
Mr. Oney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I believe in our, and I don't know under federal law, but I for sure, but I do believe the case is that there is a broad notice to parents that under federal and state law, and this would be in the student handbook, that data could be shared for specific purposes as allowed by statute and under federal law.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. Representative Kunesh-Podein, I don't see a Senate companion on this. I certainly align with your desire to provide as best of a quality education for all tribal communities, and I am, my heart is with the SMSC in my own community. So where do you go from here without Senate a companion?
Kunesh-Podein, normally we don't permit the minority to bring up the
It's Senate. After 8 o'clock, Chairman Lesh. Give me some levity.
Well, she's heading over to the Senate, so maybe I'll let her answer. Maybe she has an opinion. Go ahead, Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are working on that at the moment. We are hoping that we'll be able to negotiate an agreement. And they sometimes like to see how things go over here before they make that that final commitment. And so we will take the consequences of this meeting and share it with our Senate partners, and hopefully they will jump on board and we'll get it done by the end of the week.
She is, Representative Albright, she is right about that. We usually end up doing the heavy lifting anyway, and then the Senate takes credit, so.
There's a lot that's brewing over there that they aren't, you know, putting out in front of us, that's kind of working on the background, waiting to see how it goes over here. So I'm optimistic.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Rooney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that too, Representative Albright, that there isn't a formal companion to this bill. However, this provision is contained in another bill in the House that was heard in education policy, and that has a companion over in the Senate that's being carried by Senator Torres Ray, and it contains this provision. Additionally, during regular session, it was contained in the department's policy bill. I know that we have a whole new set of bills now, but the provision has been introduced in the Senate in various fashions.
Well, there you go. Okay. Any other questions, Representative Albright? I'm giving you all this latitude because I don't have anyone else on the list either. So,
Mr. Chair, I thought it was just the quality of the questions.
Well, it was that. That's what I meant to say. Are there any other questions that folks have of Representative Kunesh-Podein or Mr. Oney? Okay.
Mr. Chair, this is Lucero. I wasn't going to speak, but if you're soliciting questions, I'm sure I could come up with a dozen
not
or
for you.
Four.
You drank your fill. I don't know. No, I do you have a question, Representative Lucero?
Nope, I do not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, we don't have any amendments to House File 97. Seeing no further discussion, the motion.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill has one.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had my hand up, but I know you've got a lot of screens. My question to Representative Kunesh-Podein is if she'd be willing to add an amendment as this moves forward to include the requirement for parental consent to share the data. I think with that, we would probably get more consensus from the minority party.
Representative Kunesh-Podein?
It's something that I would consider. I would like to have, I guess, more consideration and have a little bit more understanding of how that might affect the movement or the acceptance of this bill on the other side of the in the Senate. So, I mean, I'm not saying no, but I'm not saying yes.
To the extent
I understand where you're coming from as a teacher, you know, as a parent myself, I get it, but well, you know, we can talk about it.
Representative Kunesh Badin, to the extent it's worth anything at all, I would look on that very favorably if you were able to accommodate that or work toward it in any case. Mr. Chair,
thank you for indulging me. Representative O'Neill, Representative Kunesh Badin, just speaking that this proposal was put forth to us by Representative Scott earlier in the session before the legislature went on the short hiatus, and as well in an April hearing on the matter. Took the proposal to the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and they felt strongly that that would put them on a lower accessibility to the 17 other uses and entities that would be able to access educational data without parental consent. The whole purpose of this statute is to be able to access educational data without parental consent. So to add someone in with parental consent would be counter to what the purpose of the law is. So I would have to say at this point, the department would oppose that proposal.
Any other comments, questions? The motion is that House File 97 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott. Representative Albright.
Yes.
Representative Barr.
Yes.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan. Representative Kerr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani. Representative Noor.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Yes.
Representative Robbins.
Yes.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
On a vote of 15 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is sent to the general register. Thank you very much, Representative Kunesh Badin. Members,
thank you.
There is no other business before the committee tonight. Thank you for your indulgence of pushing this back to the late hour, but we did get this done in almost before 9 o'clock. It was an important bill and an important conversation and discussion. Ms. Ghanani, do we have anything else posted?
We do not as of now.
Nothing else is posted as yet. And I guess it remains to be seen. So keep an eye on your email, members, to determine whether or not we're going to be meeting any more this week. But again, thank you very much. Get some rack, and we will see you around. Committee is adjourned.